Tomorrow's midnight will remorselessly arrive, and so will the pain, the hope, the fear, the ecstasy that years bring. But whether what comes after is a new dawn or a polar darkness, we cannot yet know. All we can do is to summon up our courage and our wisdom and go forward. This was how the New York Times ended its piece on the 30th of December 1956. The year which had begun as one containing no shortage of ill omens, with a malfunctioning celebration in Times Square most notably, was now at an end. And what a year it had been! But it wasn't all revolution and revolt. 1956 was the year in which the rental of top hats was authorized in East Germany for the first time since the war, noted the New Yorker, adding a bit of levity, perhaps, to everything which had been experienced. The year had reached everyone differently. It was a time of radical change in the United States, where the Montgomery bus boycott had dominated national headlines, and Martin Luther King was preparing his most famous acts. In April 1956, a country few Americans had even heard of, Vietnam, had become the destination for American military advisors. It was the beginning of a commitment, which was to end in disaster. Disaster, certainly, had visited the world in different ways. Apartheid was receiving its first challenges in South Africa. Mao Zedong was implementing the initial principles of his 100 Flowers Blooming campaign, which was to end in bloody farce. Decolonization challenged the Dutch, the French, and indeed the British in radically different ways. All over the world, proclaimed Martin Luther King in early 1957. Men are in revolt. Africa's present ferment for independence, Hungary's death struggle against communism, and the determined drive of Negro Americans to become first-class citizens are inexorably bound up together. Few could have challenged this assertion, since a review of all that had occurred in the 12 months of 1956 spoke for itself. All over the world, from Havana to Cairo, from Johannesburg to Warsaw, from Budapest to Montgomery, the citizens of the world had taken to the streets. They had taken up arms and they had taken a stand. The Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement, and our very world would never be the same again. And this was despite the fact that some of these attempts to change the world had ended in bitter defeat. Hungarians were bought off by one of the more lenient flavors of communism under Janos Kadar, the revolutionary and ally of Imre Nagy, turned Soviet stooge. Kadar remained in place until the 1980s, but he did seem to genuinely care about the Hungarian people, instituting reforms and guaranteeing freedoms which went much further than Hungary's eastern neighbours, and maintained standards of living and wages which were at odds with even parts of Russia. But the underlying principle remained plain. There would be no more secret police visits at stupid o'clock in the morning, so long as all accepted the one-party state as law, and did nothing to challenge the Soviet grip on power. Silence was taken as consensus. There was no longer any need for artificial displays of public happiness or loyalty. As Kadar himself put it, it wasn't the case that if Hungarians were not with us, then they were against us, but instead, he who is not against us is with us. The supposed consensus in favour of Soviet rule was preserved, but there could be no hiding the fact that the Soviet Empire was built on nothing more than military force. The fact, which is so obvious to us today, that Russia effectively kept her smaller eastern neighbours under her thumb, was revealed in all of its crushing nakedness in early November, when the incredible story of the Hungarian people was brought to a sickening end. The cynical way in which Soviet tanks obliterated Budapest's fight for freedom was, in the final analysis, inevitable if Khrushchev wished to keep the Soviet Union together. Only through force, plainly, could this be done. But to those who viewed the Soviet Union as some great socialist experiment, this revelation was as striking as it was disappointing. Young communists across the world were left disenchanted. In Western Europe, the example of Hungary served as the indefensible argument against the Moscow regime. Defenders of communism, increasingly, came to argue that it was not the Russians who promoted the ideology in its pure form, but the revolutionaries across the world instead, such as, increasingly, in Cuba. If Budapest was a wake-up call for the world, it was also one for Moscow. The attempt to liberalise, which was laid out in the secret speech, could only go so far, and Khrushchev's successors discovered in 1968, when tanks rolled mercilessly into Prague, that Soviet communism and personal, unlimited freedom of expression could not coexist together. It was a lesson that Budapest's residents understood all too well in the years after their failed revolt. Acceptance of the Soviet creed was simply incompatible with liberalism, and the creed could only be stretched so far before it began to bend and crack, leaving the Soviet bloc vulnerable to revolution by citizens who wanted to go that bit further. Khrushchev was replaced in 1964, but his efforts to modernise and liberalise were not forgotten, as the new men of the Communist Party rose up in Russia. Gorbachev would discover in the 1980s that the mission of modernisation through reform was a balance too delicate to manage, and then the whole project would come crashing down. 1956 had provided a glimpse of this future into the Soviet Union, but it was not yet time to fully live it. While the Soviets had maintained their iron grip by the most cynical of methods, other actors in the year were less fortunate. France continued to buckle following the Suez debacle, and its possession of Algeria remained a source of bitter division and bloody conflict for several more years. So severe was the challenge which the Algerian conflict posed to French identity and culture that no less a person than Charles de Gaulle was swept to power, and by summer 1958 had done away with the tainted Fourth French Republic. By that point, the war in Algeria reached a fever pitch, and the French colonists, the Pieds Noirs, who lived in Algeria, had begun to radicalise and undermine the very concept of French democracy. This was all too much for de Gaulle, and following protracted negotiations in March 1962, France extricated itself from its bloodiest colonial war, and Algeria, shortly after, declared its independence from France. By then the country had already begun to shed its settler population, but a veritable flood followed as more than 700,000 white French settlers moved to France from Algeria between April and August of 1962 alone. The legacy of years of colonialism was being undone in a single season, and through the actions of daring politicians. Across the channel, such daring politicians seemed to be in short supply. The all-encompassing challenge of Suez had hid the fact that Britain was more heavily involved in the war in Cyprus in 1956 than at any other point. Not until 1959 would the conflict in Cyprus be brought to an end on the island, and the familiar division of that country came to pass. Few pundits or observers wanted to talk about Cyprus in 1956, though. Most wanted to talk about Suez and have their pressing questions answered, but the Tories were not talking. To some British statesmen on the opposition benches, they did not merely assume collusion with France and Israel, but also collusion with the Soviet enemy. Considering the perfect storm which the simultaneous conflicts created, we should not be surprised that statesmen in the dark about Anthony Eden's conspiracy should think the worst of his government. One Labour MP, Kenneth Younger, expressed his view in the House of Commons on the 8th of November 1956, saying, "We know as a fact that on Monday the 29th of October, before any of these events in Egypt had occurred, the eyes of the world were on Eastern Europe. The Kremlin was rather obviously balanced between the two possible decisions, whether they would allow the Hungarian Revolution to go ahead, as they had allowed the Polish Revolution to go, or whether to intervene massively. We may fairly surmise, may we not, I put it no higher than that, that one of the considerations in their mind was the damage which a brutal intervention on their part would undoubtedly do to the worldwide Soviet pretensions to be the champions of national independence, especially in Asia and Africa. We know that by Tuesday night, all eyes, and particularly the eyes of Asia and Africa, had switched to Egypt. We know that the news of the aggression by Western powers against a Muslim nation, against an Afro-Asian country, effectively blotted out the news of Soviet repression in Hungary, and continued to do so right up to the ceasefire. I ask, honourable members, is there anyone in the House who feels entitled to assume that this did not enter at all into the calculations of the Soviet decision?" Indeed, the actions in Suez did blot out events in Hungary, and it complemented the Soviet invasion so masterfully that some sort of shady deal was expected to surface eventually. But this specific shady deal did not exist. Eden had concocted a far more controversial one, the secrets of which he would take to his grave, but which are now common knowledge. For some in Eden's government, the task of defending their Prime Minister's policies was a daunting one indeed, so they tried to focus on arguments which must be familiar now to anyone following current British politics, i.e. that the current policy might produce consequences and it might be painful, but that in the future, everything will prove to have been worth it. As Sir Ian Fraser, Tory MP and former director of the BBC, attempted to claim on the same day that Kenneth Younger posed his challenge, with an artificial sense of perception, Fraser attempted to state, "I believe, and I think that the historian looking back from, say, the year 2000, will see that this week Israel was saved from extinction. I believe that she has been saved. I believe that she would have been extinguished, not necessarily in that week, but in the weeks that followed, if we had not intervened. That is point number one. It is an important one for the world as well as for our morality. I think it is possible that we have now inspired the United Nations into realization of its weakness. And if mankind is now ready to make up a force which can intervene and intervene swiftly and timely, then I believe history will show that we have rendered another notable and signal service to mankind. I do not believe that any but incidents of the kind that we have recently witnessed could have jogged a dilatory, talkative assembly and a thwarted, frustrated Security Council into the degree of thought which they have now reached in this matter. That, I think, is the major gain to be put on the credit side of the events of this last week." Fraser and many of his peers may well have believed these claims, but the year 2000 has passed, and now more than ever, the Suez Crisis has come to be seen for what it was, a criminal act of conspiracy, sponsored and authored by a Prime Minister unequalled, perhaps, in modern British history for his pettiness, naivety, and ultimately his failures. Even a few months after the event, historians were proceeding with their judgments on Eden's ministry, and the commentaries were far from favourable. The historian Graham Spry, writing in 1957 for the journal International Affairs, was possessed of a true sense of perception, and laid out what he believed was the true consequences of Eden's policy, writing, "It is already clear that the policy pursued by Britain ran counter to the best established associations of Britain and France, contradicted the basic policy of concert, and for a few days in November, threatened to evoke against Britain perhaps the most powerful possible coalition of interests in her experience. It may have been, it is true, only a coalition of opinion and emotion, but if Anglo-French policy had been continued rather than revised, what would have been the consequences of such a coalition in action against Britain and France?" Disastrous though it was, for Suez portrayed Eden in the most cynical light to all but his firmest supporters, the crisis did not dramatically transform the British situation. Its reputation was deservedly tarnished, but its power and influence in the Middle East was not destroyed or undermined overnight. It would take more than Suez to undo the centuries of imperialism in that part of the world. Yet Suez was a watershed moment, and it did hint at what was to come in the region, in the event that troublesome minor powers refused to do what Britain asked. British force was used four times in the Middle East in the next 4 years, against Oman, Jordan, Kuwait and Aden between 1957 and 61. British imperial power was not about to vanish, and the decline had been in place long before Suez, as decolonization ran across the world. Perhaps the most startling aspect of Suez isn't what it suddenly did to Britain's position, but how stark the chasm between reality and ambition was. Britain, contrary to what Eden and his followers might have claimed or how they had behaved, was operating in 1956 and not 1856, and the world had moved on. The geopolitical realities of the era made it plain that an island nation far away from the Middle East could no longer claim the loyalty or forcibly subjugate unruly powers. The writing was on the wall as Britain released India, Sudan, Malaya, the Gold Coast and a whole range of other territories before and after the Suez debacle. It was believed to be too costly to cling on to these territories, but to Eden, Egypt was different. He only realised how different after the event, noting ruefully that Suez had not so much changed our fortunes as revealed realities. These realities struck Eden as soon as he arrived home from holiday in mid-December 1956. The Prime Minister seemed relaxed and even tanned, but his absence had not made British hearts grow fonder, nor had Eden's health sufficiently improved. On the 9th of January 1957, Eden was driven to Buckingham Palace, where he handed his letter of resignation to the Queen. One wonders if Queen Elizabeth II remembers this event today, because it was certainly a moment of great significance. There was no clearer admission of political defeat than this. Eden had manifestly failed to turn the situation in Egypt around, and while he and his supporters would claim that the United Nations had been energised, Israel had been saved, and all manner of other lame excuses, the facts of the matter were that Colonel Nasser had been greatly empowered, and Britain had not got its own way after all. Certainly these defeats took a toll on Eden's already frail health, but there was something tragic and wrong about Eden getting to this point in the first place, where he resigned following such a shambolic and shameful foreign policy programme. Was this not the same Eden who had resigned in 1938 over his principled opposition to appeasement? To many onlookers, the Eden of 1938 was a distant memory. Politically, Suez presented further disasters for the British. The act which had been taken in league with France effectively shunted France to the edge of the British friendship. Guy Millay had needed Nasser's removal to follow, otherwise Egyptian support of the Algerian rebels would continue and France's position would remain ruinous. Eden, by contrast, wished only to invade, to seize the canal, to restore British prestige and have some ill-defined form of revenge upon Nasser. Eden almost certainly expected Nasser to fall from power and perhaps even be assassinated once the invasion had been a success. Eden could never have predicted what would have happened next, as the French, seeing their ambitions in Egypt frustrated, and blaming Britain at least partially for this, moved closer to West Germany, and the following year after 1956, the Treaty of Rome was signed, which served as the first major milestone in the history of the institution that we know today as the European Union. As French policy moved closer to the continent, Britain was pulled in contradictory directions and lost out on the opportunity which Rome presented. This loss wouldn't matter, Eden imagined, as long as Britain retained the support of the United States. It was the American friendship, the Atlantic partnership, which was of true importance to Britain. But Eden couldn't even keep that. Only through Harold Macmillan's furious diplomatic efforts after the event was the Anglo-American partnership repaired, but it was never truly the same again. Henceforth, British Prime Ministers did not act in any major sense, especially in foreign policy programs aimed at former colonies, without first acquiring American approval. American intervention in Suez, as we have seen, did not create as much pressure as is often assumed, since Macmillan made sure to massively exaggerate the impact that American action would have on the Treasury. But if this fact is forgotten, then so too is the point that Suez, from beginning to end, was an abject military disaster. The British, it is sometimes pointed out, went into World War II with World War I era tactics and went into Korea with World War II equipment. Suez was the incompetent mess of both, as neither British soldiers nor British suppliers were adequate for the task. This wasn't the fault of the British personnel, but of those politicians and aged commanders who imagined the task force into being. Operation Musketeer, the original plan to land in Egypt, was done away with to the chagrin of the French and replaced with an even more poorly conceived plan. The opposition which the Egyptians would present to the Anglo-French Act was completely underestimated by both high commands. Rather than topple at the first sign of a coordinated attack from the British and French, Nasser sank block ships in the Suez Canal and he put boxes of small arms about the streets to arm the Egyptian citizens, who eagerly obliged. The war in Suez, and it was unmistakably a war, no matter what Eden or his French counterpart attempted to claim, was unlike Korea in another aspect. It did not at all command the enthusiasm which was present, at least initially, when news of North Korea's invasion was learned of. Since I planned and wrote and produced, etc., 1956, while I was doing the Korean War, or at least with the Korean War fresh in my mind, this stark difference between the two events was always particularly striking for me, and I often wondered just how Eden expected things to have been otherwise. Imagine the scene. You're a reservist, having long settled down into civilian life. Perhaps you haven't trained in several years since you came home from Korea, when you suddenly receive a letter summoning you to report to the nearest barracks. These scenes had been experienced during the early phases of the Korean War, but at least in 1950, the British enjoyed the support of the United States and of the United Nations. Public opinion, a surprisingly important resource as Eden learned, was weighed against Britain in the UN General Assembly, even among those members of the Commonwealth, who it was always assumed would back Britain no matter the consequences or situation. Britain did not deserve blind loyalty at Suez, nor did Eden truly deserve Lester Pearson, who did so much as Canada's foreign minister to save Britain from the worst consequences of foreign embarrassment. The UN Emergency Force, which Eden forever after took credit for, was much more the result of Lester Pearson's networking, negotiating and quick thinking than of the Prime Minister's conspiring. So what did we learn from Suez, from the Hungarian Revolt, or from 1956 generally? Hopefully, for all of you lovely patrons, the series has been an enjoyable one, even with its stop-start release schedule and occasionally slow pace. Personally, I have found a new respect for those actors who populated the early phase of the Cold War, and I've also confirmed my distaste for figures like Eden, who refused to get with the programme. I still find it incredible that the Prime Minister could have pursued, willingly, such a clearly wrong and unsuitable policy to the extent that his mental health remains a topic for debate today. In the last analysis, though, 1956 and all that it contained was something more than just another calendar year of the 20th century. It was the eventful year, the year when the scales fell from men's eyes like never before, when imaginations ran wild to the detriment of freedoms, when conspiracies gained acceptance, when lies were told on the grand stage to audiences of millions, when fears were realised, hopes crushed, cynicism reigned, and bravery won out. 1956 was many different things to different people at different times, but it was unquestionably a year of great significance, and I've really enjoyed bringing its stories to you guys over the past 18 months. 1956 has now come to an end, but When Diplomacy Fails is not going to back down from the challenge into launching another special series for its wonderful patrons. If you enjoyed 1956, then great! Why not tell someone? If you're happy to wave goodbye to this era, which we first dipped our toe into all the way back in January 2018, then I am also happy to hear it, because I've got something special for you. Poland Is Not Yet Lost launches in 3 weeks today on Monday the 16th of September, and will run every other week in line with our release schedule for the 30 Years' War. Make sure you check out the story on our social media machines, the Twitter, Facebook group and Facebook page, but until then, I must say huge thanks to all of you for joining me for this story, and I hope you're ready for yet another incredible tale soon.